Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast of two siblings who love books.
One particular sibling who loves books so much that she decided to go into quite a bit of a debt to study them.
I was going to say, tell us how much you love books.
I love books so much. I moved halfway across the country and did all sorts of crazy things.
So, yeah, we're doing a special episode this week. We're not doing it on a specific book. And we're actually going to talk about the publishing industry quite a bit this week.
Woohoo! Basically, I'm just gonna, say, I learned stuff in grad school, guys.
Yeah, we're just gonna get a grad school download from Gabs because she doesn't have time to read any non-school books right now.
Yeah, and actually, I had this super delightful experience yesterday where one of my InDesign files, so like my master's project this semester, is I'm designing, I think I might have mentioned this, but I'm designing The Secret Garden of Little Princess and Little Lord Fauntleroy, which are all Frances Hodgson Burnett. And you talked about The Secret Garden last time, and my file for the entire interior text of A Little Princess wouldn't open, and InDesign would not give me an error, so I couldn't, troubleshoot. It just said, can't open file, but it didn't say why. And so I, texted my friend Rhea in a panic because she, professionally works on InDesign, and I was like, well, what do I do? And she's like, try all these things, and then we both, Googled shit, and found someone who had the exact same problem as me, but the thing that fixed his file did not fix my file. So I emailed my professor, and I was like, hey, this happened to me today. This is what I've tried. Do you have any ideas? And her reply was, if I were you, I would open a nice bottle of red, sit down, and start redoing the file. And I was like, oh, fuck. So I am now typesetting for a second time the complete text of A Little Princess.
Great.
So I can send it to the printer next week. So I was like, that's nice. It's a good thing to have happened to me. So that was a fun surprise.
Yeah, that is a fun surprise.
Yeah.
And
it actually ended up being, weirdly fortuitous because I was, actually emailing the printer to get a quote, and I was, double-checking the lengths of all the books, and that's how I discovered it wouldn't open because I couldn't open it to check on the page count. And I was like, man, if I had, decided to email the printer next week and, hadn't thought about it and just assumed the file was fine.
Oh, man.
Then I could have discovered, 3 days ahead of time that the file was busted. I was actually, okay with it. Immediately backed up everything else I've done this semester and was like, all right.
Yeah, that's certainly not a thing you want to have happen to you, but if it's going to happen, you'd like to at least have the opportunity to fix it before having to get on your knees and beg for an extension.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially since I bet the computer ate my file is the go-to excuse anymore.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be lying, but...
Right.
My professor knows that I had, all the interiors done before yesterday.
Sure.
but, yeah. I was like, that could have been a really fun all-nighter. 10 hours of pure hell, staying up.
Gross.
All night trying to get this book typeset, so.
Gross.
So I don't have to do that. I'm very happy about it.
That's right.
I get to talk to you tonight instead of weeping in the corner.
You get to talk to me, which is like a punishment of its own, but a different one.
A different kind.
That's right. So before I start asking my publishing questions, shall we go ahead and remind everybody that we're part of the Minerva Podcast Network?
Yes.
I know
we are, in fact, part of the Minerva Magazine Podcast Network, found at www.minervamag.com.
It's charming.
It's charming, according to one of my professors who just discovered it, which makes me laugh. Our other podcasts include a Shakespeare podcast, a podcast about podcasts, very meta, and a podcast entirely dedicated to nostalgia. Tomorrow we are actually playing a game of Candyland and podcasting it.
Nice.
So we have a good time. You guys should check Minerva. If you like Ben and I, you will probably like at least one other thing you find on Minerva. Especially because Ben and I have both produced other content.
Right. I was going to say, I'll practically guarantee it. All right. Well, I think I'll get to it here. So why don't you start by telling us about your personal experience, specialty, basically, what do you actually do in school? So we have a little context for your connection to the publishing world.
Yeah, so like I mentioned, I am designing 3 children's books this semester. So like my personal wheelhouse, I guess, is book production and design. The other big project I'm doing this semester is I am designing an interactive ebook of The Secret Garden. So I'm trying to like get some of my ebook cred built up, so when I apply to jobs I can be like, I can do both. My real interest lies in design and production of books, or magazines, and or basically anything print. So like, I would be happy designing like calendars for Crayola if that was my only job option. That's cool with me. Basically consists of picking typefaces, picking margins, laying stuff out on the page, making sure images are high resolution, etc. There's like a ton of nonsense that goes into it. I'm gonna try really hard not to bore people with it. As far as typesetting a book goes, I guess that might be a piece of jargon people don't actually know. So when you lay a book out in InDesign, you have to go through and make sure that it's like nicely broken up. So like some of the big things you look for, you want to avoid orphans, which is when a paragraph ends and there's only one word on the line by itself. You want to try to avoid that if at all possible, unless it's in dialogue, because if a character says like 5 words of dialogue, there's like nothing you can do to like stretch that line or shrink it really. And then you want to avoid widows, which is when a paragraph ends and the last line of the paragraph is at the top of the next page by itself. You also want to try to avoid a single line being at the end of a page by itself, but that's like a slightly less sinful, like if you have to have one line at the end of a page by itself in order to avoid having like a widow at the top of a page by itself, then that's very preferable, because it's less noticeable. So when you typeset a book, you have to go through looking for these things, and then you have to make corrections. Like you might slightly adjust word spacing within the paragraph to kind of like stretch it out a little bit longer to pop like an extra word onto the next liner, or subtract it a little bit so it kind of squeezes on one fewer line. You might add or subtract lines from a page, which is a very tricky thing. If you flip through a book, you might be able to find it where if, like, sometimes the only way to fix something is to, like, add a line to each page, and if all your running material, like your headers and your page numbers are all at the top of the page, then people don't really notice if it might be a line shorter or longer all of a sudden. So things like that.
So is the goal of this kind of thing just an aesthetic thing, or it sounds like from what you're describing that the goal isn't to like try to trim a page or two off the end or something like that?
No, yeah, it's purely like the rules of good typesetting like have been agreed upon, that like these are the things you want to avoid, like orphans and widows and stuff.
Right.
And so like your job is to basically go through and try to eliminate all of the like gross design faux pas stuff, basically, in any way that you can, and so, as creatively as you can.
Right. So if the typesetter is doing a good job, then as a reader, I shouldn't really even notice that it's happening, right?
Exactly.
even if I go and look for it with the modicum of knowledge you just gave me?
you like might go, oh, hey, like, there's a thing, or if you do find, like, an orphan, for example, then you might look to see if the designer left it there to avoid some other bigger, like, problem.
Right.
I do that, at least. I actually don't know if, like, a layman could do that or not, but...
Fair enough.
So I'm particularly interested in children's books. I've had an internship at a children's publisher. I've taken a children's publishing class. So, like, most of my, specialized publishing knowledge is in the children's publishing arena. But my particular program teaches us we have to take an ebook, a book, a print book, and a magazine, like, overview class, so we kind of get a general awareness of everything. And then some people in my program are focusing purely on magazine writing, and some people focus more on editorials, some people focus more on ebooks. So you can actually, like, go into my publishing program, and, like, there are several people in my class who are graduating from the same program, but with, like, an entirely different specialty than I am. So it's kind of cool that way. Where you can focus pretty much on, like, what you want to do. It was a little harder for me because I was interested in design and production, and there's not that much. That's why I designed both of my own projects that I'm doing this semester, and I had to fight with the school to convince them to let me do it because there were no other design classes for me to take. But, yeah.
But you do what you have to do.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to read most of these questions pretty close to verbatim just so everybody can hear how glib I am when I'm talking to you and not to them. At this point, it's pretty obvious that ebooks are a thing. Are they more of a thing than printed books? Are they on pace to be? I guess I assume that eventually they will be, and kind of suspect in certain, maybe, genres they already are?
Oh, more of a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, a genre like romance, for example, is probably pretty ebook popular.
Yeah, if you're burning through a bunch of books a month, then it... Why weigh down your shelves with printed copies when you can just keep it on your Kindle?
Yeah. So my answer to this is, like, yes, ebooks are a thing, but they're not more of a thing than printed books, and they are not actually on a pace to be more of a thing than printed books. So this is, like, one of the weirdo, crazy things. I mean, okay, so first I just wanted to, like, throw out a little bit of knowledge. So Kindles were not introduced into the market until late 2007, which means that ebooks have been, like, easily accessible to the public for less than 10 years. So I guess, first of all, it's still a really new market, and everything that you say about it might be completely different in 10 years.
Right.
But we actually talked about this in my ebook overview class, where... Everyone was, like, freaking out about the death of print for a while because ebooks, for their first several years, were growing at this, like, insane exponential rate, and everyone's like, oh my god, the print book is dead. But over the past couple years, they've actually leveled off. So I did not look up, like, a specific study to double-check this, but what we talked about in my class was that ebook sales... are about 25% of the total market and have leveled off at about 25%. And the reason that they were growing like crazy the first couple years was because there had been no ebooks before that point. And what publishers did is they were like, here's a new revenue stream. Let's convert every single book that we have ever published in the history of the world into ebook format. And then everyone was like, oh, like, here's all these ebooks that I can buy. No. but now that most publishers have caught up, like, any of their viable backlist in ebook form, they're pretty much only converting anything that's new on the market to ebook, which means that way fewer ebooks are flooding the market than were flooding the market in 2008, 2009, 2010.
Right.
So, like, that growth was actually kind of, like, misleading in that way. And the other thing we talked about is that Ebooks are super convenient and nice, and like I definitely have like a combination of print and ebooks.
Yeah, same here.
But people, like, there's something about a print book that you just can't really create, and people are always going to want print books, especially like really nice print books.
Sure.
So we talked about how like a really nicely produced hardcover, if people want to buy books like that, an ebook can't replace that. And so my professor suggested that the real, like, ebooks are not a threat to books in general. They're the biggest threat to mass market paperbacks.
Right. So it's a bigger, it's a bigger threat where people want the book for the text as opposed to wanting it for their collection of books.
Yeah. It's like, because buying an ebook is kind of the equivalent of being at the grocery store and being like, oh yeah, that book, I'm going to buy that.
Right.
Like, now you might be on Amazon and be like, oh yeah, everyone's reading that, I'll just get it on my ebook. Because, like, a crappy mass market, like, you're like, oh, whatever, like, I'm just going to read the book. Whereas if you buy, like, the nice trade version of it, then you're not really a person who's going to, like, completely convert to ebooks anyway.
Right.
So there's that going on. And then there's other formats where, like, ebooks will, unless, like, the technology changes. My ebook professor is hilarious because he, like, hates e-readers and thinks ebooks look terrible, but he, like, does them for
right.
a living. But, like, nice art books, photography books, and actually children's picture books are super hard to convert to ebooks and make them look really nice, because there's just like this control you have over print to make it look really nice. And so those sorts of things will always be popular in the printed format, and ebooks aren't really a threat to those.
So I'm going to change up our question order slightly because I think this fits with what we were talking about. But it seems like audiobooks are on the rise, or maybe it's just because I listen to podcasts and all of them all of the ones that people actually listen to advertise Audible.
So, Audible, contact us.
That's right. Uh-huh. So, are audiobooks actually on the rise? Is that a problem or a challenge for traditional publishers? It strikes me like being another income stream, which most businesses like. But it also seems like there would be, some, I would think, self-evident differences in producing them compared to something printed.
Yeah, so we haven't really talked about audiobooks too much in my program, but I will talk about my own, experiences learning about them. So, I would say they're not a problem for traditional publishers, and traditional publishers like audiobooks. I personally think they are on the rise, just because Audible, the amount of books they offer is, like, crazy expanded from when they started. So I think a lot of people are probably listening to audiobooks now. But the great thing about it for publishers, in, like you said, is it's an additional revenue stream, and the publisher is in charge of getting the audiobook produced, but then they own rights to it. So if, like, they say, hey, Audible, do you want to sell whatever? Like, they get a cut of, you know, every audiobook that's sold. So when I worked for Candlewick, they made audiobooks of a lot of their books, and they go through, like, a third party. So there's this company called Brilliance Audio, which, if you listen to audiobooks, you might actually hear, like, pay attention, and at the beginning or the end, you'll probably hear, this has been a Brilliance Audio production. They're, right. like the audiobook company. And basically, you, like, send them the text, and you're like, hey, can you please produce and direct and whatever this audiobook? And then Brilliance Audio, like, puts the whole thing together for the publisher and then sends them, like, all the different copies. So I believe, and I don't know this, like, for 100% fact, that the publisher would pay Brilliance Audio, like, X amount to produce the audiobook for them. And I know that you also, depending on who is reading the book, the publisher may have to fork out more money. So, like, if
I see.
Publishing...
So, like, if I write, if I somehow get a book published and and I read it, then that's probably not that expensive. Or if a professional reader, voice actor type person does it, that's probably a flat fee. But if they get, I don't know, if Brad Pitt decides to read my book for some reason, that's probably a lot more expensive.
Exactly, yes. So, yeah, if you produce a book and you're like, oh, we really want, yeah, like some famous person, we want Tina Fey to read this book, you're probably have to pay her quite a bit of money.
Right.
And so the publisher kind of has to decide how worth it is it to, like, you know, like, I'm assuming having Amy Poehler read her own memoir is, like, a very good choice. But then having her read, like, The Secret Garden is, like, why are you doing that? In my children's publishing class, our professor mentioned, like, for one particular book, they ended up having more money than they expected, like, when they realized, like, oh, you know, here we paid for all this stuff, we're going to have more money left over. And so they actually, like, pitched in that extra money to, like, hire, like, a pseudo-celebrity to do the audio version to put into the, like, back cover so that they could, like, use that as a selling point. But, yeah, like, publishers do audiobooks of tons of their books already, and it's like I personally, like, don't know how much of a help it is to, like, the overall profits, but it's definitely not, like, a problem because you own all the rights to the book, so when you produce the audiobook, that's only making you more money.
All right, well, since you mentioned profits, what kind of profit margins do publishers have? Where are they making their money? Why do books cost what they cost? Which I think is kind of... I suspect questions 3 and 4 on the outline kind of roll into each other.
Yeah. So this is probably not that surprising, but publishers' profit margins are not big.
Yeah. What? I thought every author was getting, like, $1 million advances because the royalties were so steep.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. That's why people who work in the publishing industry just make 6 figures, like, across the board.
Right.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, so producing a book is really expensive, and then you can't, they're not considered luxury goods. They're considered just, you know, like, they're kind of just middle of the road, like, consumer goods, and so you can't charge a lot for them, so you don't have, like, huge profit margins. So what you have to do, we actually talked about this in my book publishing class, is that publishers on most first runs of most of the books they publish, they actually expect to, like, probably break even and not actually make a profit, because the cost of printing the books is so much, and then, like, marketing and shipping them and, like, whatever else you have to do, and then however big the author's advance is, that by the time right. you sell those off, you've probably broken even.
So how many, I think this would be an interesting way to break it down maybe, but like, what are the processes involved from getting a book from author all the way to actually on the shelf? Like, how many different people are we talking about that have to be involved with it?
Yeah, so you have your acquisitions editor. So there are different types of editors, which is super fun. So you have an acquisitions editor who, like, finds the book and says, hey, we should buy this for whatever reason. Depending on the publisher you work for, you might throw together a proposal and, like, pitch it to a bunch of people who then have to decide, like, whether or not to accept the book. Then you accept the book. Then it goes to, like, the content editor who, like, actually works with the author one-on-one. Once they're done with it, and this is kind of depending, like, if we're just talking, like, general fiction, then it moves on. If you're talking about, like, a nonfiction book, you might have to send it off to other professionals in the field to help you vet it. You might have to send it, I mean, like, you might have to do, like, a lot of other crazy, like, fact-checking things.
So if, like, a mass publisher, and I don't know. I don't want to pick one out of the air, but like if a mass market type of publisher is doing a nonfiction book, how much vetting would you expect? I mean, we're not talking an academic publisher, so I'd assume it's not like full on peer review, but they do some like spot checking. They do like some spot checking and fact checking to hopefully make sure that the person whose autobiography it isn't completely made up out of whole cloth.
And this honestly, how much vetting it goes through kind of depends on how much money you have.
Ah, okay.
Because there was this big scandal, and I unfortunately can't remember this author's name. There was this historian who's like, books were selling really well, and the publisher is like, hey man, we'll give you a contract for like your next 3 books, because this is going great. And they kind of pressured him into a situation where he like was expected to get his next book out more quickly than he was like really able to.
Right.
And, they trusted the guy at this point, and they found out that, like, he had plagiarized some stuff, and that, like, he had some researchers do work for him, and then, like, basically, like, stole their shit.
Right.
And just threw it into the book. And they didn't know that until after it was printed, and it was, like, a big thing. So, like, one of the risks you run is you can either, like, spend a lot of money and time entirely vetting it, but, like, that slows down the whole process, or you can put like the onus of factual checking on the author themselves, and then when they turn it into you, you say, okay, everything's true, and if it's not true and like there's a plagiarism issue, like you're gonna get like in trouble for it, not us. But you don't want that to happen to you, because if you publish a plagiarized book, like it looks really bad for the publisher, even if it's like not really their fault.
Right.
So but yeah, not full on peer review. One of the things we talked about is it kind of depends on the type of nonfiction it is. So like for a cookbook, you would actually pay someone to go cook all the recipes and make sure like none of them are poison, and make sure that they all work, so that like someone can't say, I made your chocolate chip cookie recipe and it like killed my dog or whatever.
How do I get that gig, by the way?
Yeah. And then, like, one of my professors, he used to work for, like, an outdoors publisher, like a hiking, mountaineering-type publisher. And he said that if someone was publishing a book of, like, hikes to take, you would have to send someone to, like, go make sure the places they said to park were right, and go make sure, like, basically making sure, like, someone who followed this person's directions would stay safe the whole time.
Right.
So, like the book's not accidentally, like, leading you down a ditch, and, like, someone who buys your guide is gonna, like, die, like, doing this hike.
But right.
Like, you want to make sure you're not liable for hurting people. So for certain types of nonfiction, you're, like, basically just checking and make sure, like, everything's, like, or if you have, like, a construction sort of thing, you'd want to make sure like someone couldn't actually electrocute themselves or like whatever.
Right.
For like a straight history, you probably would put more of it onto the author to like have people in their field check out the manuscript, like, and then you would assume like it was probably okay.
Yeah, call your friend in the history department somewhere and say, hey, will you read this for me?
I just read 1776, which is a trade publication, and at the back of the book, he was basically like, thank you to these, like, 15 other historians who all looked over this for me and, like, gave me advice. So, like, he clearly did his research, but I'm guessing the publisher did not, like, bother to go to every single reference and make sure, like, it was...
Right. All right. Well, that was an interesting tangent.
Yeah. Okay, so you have your acquisitions editor who picks up the book. You have the editor who works one-on-one with the person. You potentially have, like, one or two outside people doing, like, fact-checking or something else. You send it to the copy editor who... the copy editor is sort of like a fact-checker. They basically go through and look for, like, clarity and consistency and things like that. So they might say, like, oh, hey, on page 57, you described this character as having blue eyes, and on page 190, they have brown eyes, and then you need to fix that inconsistency. Or, like, you say it's cloudy, and then, like, later the sun is out. Like, things like that. So the copy editor kind of helps clear up any of that things like that maybe the editor missed. Then it would go to the design team. So you typically have one person who's working on the cover, but they have to answer to, like, so you have a designer working on the cover who answers to the art director. So the editor and the art director will give the designer some, like, feedback or guidance on how to design the cover. And then, like, they'll go back and forth. And then you send the cover to marketing, and then marketing comes back and says, no, we can't sell this, you have to change it. And then so you change it so marketing's happy. So you kind of have to, like, send the cover through several different departments until that's good. Most publishers outsource their interior typesetting to freelancers.
Okay.
So you would send the interior to a freelancer that you've worked with before. Depending if how complicated the interior of the book is, if it's a really, really simple typesetting job, you might outsource it even to, like, a company in, like, India, where they don't have to, like, even read English, really. Or you might send it to someone like me, who's a recent, like, graduate student, who can do it for you pretty cheap.
Right. By the way, Gabs is available.
Yeah, I'm happy to typeset books all the live long day for people. I would love to do that. So you have the designer of the cover, and they will send the freelancer, like, by the way, I'm including this design element. Can you please, like, include? So, like, they might give some guidance to, like, what the interior should look like, depending on how, you know, highly designed it is. So then that comes through. Then you have a, like, proof run of it. You have a proofreader go through it, who's basically just making sure that the printer, so you send, the printer does the first proof. You have the proofreader check to make sure that everything looks correctly. So they basically just, like, get to go through and make sure the printer didn't actually put, like, two periods somewhere or something crazy. So it might go through proofs. Usually you just do one pass. You might do two, kind of depending. But in the proofing stage, because you're with the printer, the more you change, the more you have to pay for it.
Right.
And then the printer runs it off, and then it gets, like, sent off and everything. So, and, like, the whole time, all of the production, like, cycle is going on, which could take a year to a year and a half, kind of depending on the book. You have the marketing and publicity teams working with the author to, like, set up maybe appearances and interviews, and the marketing team, like, figuring out what they're going to do. And you might have one person on the marketing team working on your book, or you might have, like, the entire marketing team working on your book, kind of depending on how big of a deal they think it's going to be.
Right.
So, yeah.
So by my count, we're up to about 10 people, and that's if every time you said department, only one person worked on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have, like, all sorts of stuff where, like, you have to take the book, to sales conference. So, like, you'll have a sales department, either a sales team that works specifically just for your publisher, or salespeople who work with multiple publishers. You have to go, like, inform all of the salespeople about all of your books so they can go out and try to sell them to everybody. So you will have, usually salespeople, I think there are about 5 different regions in the U.S. So you'd have at least, like, 5 different sales departments in various parts of the country working on that. And then I guess I didn't even include ebook. If you include ebook stuff, then you have to like send that through a whole nother department, plus potentially like an outsourced company. If you need an audiobook, again, to another outsourced right. company. So
you replace, to do an ebook, you replace the printer part of the process with some other process that lets you have a readable ebook, I guess.
Yeah, and usually people do a print and an ebook version, so you just
do both. Right. So basically, yeah. And I think readers are kind of getting hip to this now. I haven't heard anyone bitching about it recently, but like ebooks and traditional books cost roughly the same amount to buy.
Yeah.
And like the money you save on paper is not exactly letting you slash the prices on your ebook with all those different people involved in the quality and sales process and all that stuff.
Exactly. You're not, when you pay for a book, unless you're paying for like a super fancy art book that's going to last 100 years,
right.
You are not necessarily paying for, the paper that it's printed on because you have to pay for all of those 30 people that to right. make the book good. So, well, and they have to have a salary.
Well, in terms of the quality of the paper, that's where the term pulp when referring to fiction comes from, right?
Yes. Yeah. Shitty pulpy paper that like just falls apart and is terrible.
Those 20 cent paperbacks from like 1930 that didn't exist anymore after 1935.
Yeah. And mass market paperbacks are kind of like that.
Some
they
of them
don't last very long.
Yeah. That's to say some of them have super thin pages. And if you are reading through it a second time, you'll notice like fingerprints and grease marks all over every page, or like extreme yellowing just where you turn a page once.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. If you like pick up like a mass market book from like the 90s, they're all like yellow and disgusting. That's what I was gonna say is that so the reason like a self-published ebook is like 99 cents as opposed to like a traditional publisher, which is like $8.99, let's say. The self-published book, I mean, like, it couldn't be good, but it's because the author probably just went to Amazon and said, okay, please start selling this, and if you want to have a self-published book edited or marketed, the author has to pay for that out of pocket, and it's thousands of dollars, so right. They usually don't want to, and no one wants to spend $10 on a self-published book.
Right. Unless it's from an author they already know, probably.
Yeah, so those and those ebooks of self-published books, like through Amazon, and this is not like a diss on Amazon, but they're just like shitty ebooks. Like they didn't go through like a quality assurance test. It's basically like someone threw it like into an EPUB and was like, okay, here's an ebook.
Right.
So like those sorts of ebooks are gonna have like no sorts of features or design or like anything to them. Because it wasn't someone just, like, tossed it into a machine and said, all right, there you go, there's your ebook.
I mean, fair enough. If you're paying, like, 10% or less of the price of what a, like, publishing house ebook would cost, then you have to expect some of that.
Yeah. If I worked for Amazon, I wouldn't be like, I'm not going to, like, meticulously design your ebook. That's ridiculous.
I mean, if you were doing your own, I guess you'd still have to figure out how to distribute it. Maybe if you were doing your own ebook and you decided to meticulously go through each stage on your own because it's your own book and it's your baby, and you actually had the background on some of the technical stuff, your self-published ebook might look a little nicer than average.
Although it depends what service you go through, because Amazon, so here's a fun ebook thing.
All right.
My ebook professor gets all pissy about. So like the general open source like ebook format is called EPUB.
Uh-huh.
And you can like create it pretty much on anything, and you can use it on any device except for Kindle. And Kindle has a proprietary software they use called Mobi, and only like they can do it. So if you want to sell an ebook on Amazon and you've designed it beautifully in EPUB, then it won't work on a Kindle. You have to get a Mobi version of it.
Oh, Amazon.
Yeah, so, like, one of the reasons ebook, like, designers like iBooks is because you can create, like, a really pretty interactive ebook and then sell it on iBooks and it looks great on an iPad, but then you can't sell it for a Kindle.
Okay.
So
it's
that's
one,
like another.
It's like one of those giant companies doing proprietary things because it works for them, sort of deal, I guess.
Yeah, they can get away with it.
It's like the closest, because people basically won't put up with DRM stuff anymore, it seems like. It's like the closest, is that the closest they can get to doing it without making readers throw a shit fit?
Well, Amazon is DRM.
It is DRM. Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't tried to share any of my Kindle books, I guess. I haven't run into it.
Yeah, you can sometimes share Kindle books with other Kindle users if it's a certain title that Amazon says it's okay you can share with that person for, like, a limited amount of time. But it's one of the reasons I've considered buying print versions of all of my Kindle books and going to a different e-reader. Because I'm like, one day, if my Amazon account goes away, then I all of a sudden can't read, like, 20 of my books anymore.
Well, you see, I just learned something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a problem.
Ugh. All right. Well, I won't go on a rampage against companies that I don't like right now. But, we've kind of segued into it already, self-publishing seems like it's either going to destroy traditional publishing if you're an internet libertarian, or to basically have no effect on traditional publishing for various reasons, probably related more to business rather than the actual quality of the, you know, story, if you're more cynical like I am. Have you guys talked about this a little bit in your classes, or is this a thing you know about a little bit?
Yeah, self-publishing is definitely a thing publishers talk about because people are, like, freaking out about it all the time. So it's not going to destroy traditional publishing. Sorry,
I knew it!
Internet libertarian.
I win!
It has had an effect on traditional publishing already. I think the biggest thing that's going on is self-published books that do really well. Traditional publishers love picking those up because they're already popular, so it makes their marketing easy, and they're, like, basically guaranteed to sell. So books like The Martian, or if you've heard of The Wool series, those were both originally self-published and sold really great, and then traditional publishers were like, hey, we'll buy the rights to that for a lot of money, and the authors were like, cool.
Yeah, here you go.
or even 50 Shades of Grey was originally just a super popular fan fiction.
Right.
Which, you know, everyone knows that story. And the publisher who bought it, I don't remember if we mentioned this on the podcast before, 50 Shades of Grey made the publisher so much money that they were able to give every single person who worked for them, including the people, like, in the warehouse handling the books, a $5,000 bonus at the end of the year.
Oh, man.
So, like, I won't shit on 50 Shades of Grey. I'm like, hey, you know, like, the books were not good, but the publisher doesn't fucking care.
I think I'm pretty sure, it's been a long time because it was a pretty early episode for us, but I'm pretty sure my opinion at the time was, I hated every second I spent reading this book, but if you can make a shitload of money off of it, more power to you.
Yeah, and so that's, like, one of the big things, like, self-publishing is doing to traditional publishers. And the other thing is, like, traditional publishers kind of tend to be, like, they're, like, slowly kind of adapting to the modern age.
Right.
And so it's kind of helping, like, nudge them in that direction, which is good. Some of the other things publishers are doing, YouTube stars that are super popular are writing books, and then publishers are selling them. Things like that are happening. But one thing I wanted to say is that, like, the main, I guess, so, like, one of the great things about self-publishing for publishers when they pick up those books is, like, the guy who wrote the Wool series was basically, like, already making a ton of money and was a marketing expert. So when they bought the book off of him, the marketing team at that publisher was like, this is amazing because this guy knows what he's doing. Like, publishers don't have to train authors as much on how to market themselves.
Okay.
Because a lot of them already have some sort of online presence. And so it actually, like, really helps the publisher when authors are experienced in that way. But the big thing is that a lot of self-publishing is not edited, vetted, designed. Like, it's just kind of thrown together and shitty. And like I said, an author usually, they either have to be, like, super diligent about marketing themselves, and they have to be really smart at marketing and publicizing themselves.
Right.
Or they have to spend a lot of money, like, hiring their own publicist. And a lot of people can't really afford to do that or don't want to do that. So most self-published books just don't sell. And I read an article today that I thought was so relevant for this episode. It was like, self-published ebook sales went up last year, but traditional publishers' ebook sales went down. Like, what's the story? So I went and checked it out. And basically what they think might be happening is that so much self-publishing is flooding the market that its sales went up because there was more self-published stuff to buy this year than there was last year.
Sure.
But on average, self-published authors make $500 or less a year.
That's about what I would have guessed.
and the super big benefit of going through a traditional publisher is your advance. I mean, honestly, depending on how big your book is, might not be that much more than $500.
Right.
But you have, like, a professional team who's going to try to sell your book, and that's always going to help a lot more than just you kind of, like, blindly trying to find your way. So.
Well, sure. I mean, if you get a publisher to pick your book up in the first place, that means they think it's going to sell something.
Yeah, sell a little bit. Oh, the other point I wanted to make about these, like, about books like Fifty Shades of Grey or The Martian that, like, sell a ton of copies, even if people, like, might, you know, like, poo-poo at them. Books like that are great because when you talk about, like, publishers' margins, they make money off of books that sell a ton, and they make money off of strong backlist items. So
right.
You really want a book that's going to sell, like, 15 years down the road, because, like, some book in its 10th year might be making more of a profit based off of however many copies it sells as opposed to its first year, because you don't have to spend money on it anymore. Like, you already put all the cost into it, so everything you sell is a profit. But books like 50 Shades of Grey are the reason that publishers can publish the tiny little books that don't sell as well, that are, like, really cool and artsy and weird. Because they're like, oh, we just made, you know, $1 million off of 50 Shades of Grey, so we can post this weird book of poetry that's going to sell, like, 1,000 copies.
Yeah.
Because we can, like, afford to take a little bit of a hit. So you really should turn your nose up at books like that, because they actually help pay for, like, the little lit books that people, like, allegedly want to read.
that people allegedly want to read, but don't buy.
Yeah.
I guess segueing a little bit, but this question is worded in a silly way. I don't think I have the knowledge to ask it properly. Basically, what I want to know is what type of copyright issues people in publishing talk about as opposed to things that random dumbasses on the internet talk about.
So the two big copyright things in publishing. So the big thing that publishers, like, are finally kind of getting on board that they really struggled with was when ebooks came out, author contracts up until that point, never said anything about electronic stuff. So technically, if you went through a publisher and they had all the print rights to your book, and then the Kindle came out, you could go through someone else to get the ebook published and it would go against your contract. And that was like, publishers were like, oh no. So like now all contracts have something about electronic rights. And depending on like how good your agent is and how good the publisher is and all that stuff, you can kind of negotiate exactly like what electronic rights. And that's something that that like rights people are still really trying to figure out, because a lot of them just kind of use the blanket term of like all electronic rights. Mm-hmm. But then an author might be like, what does that mean? And so like they've been trying to kind of define it and how long they should have the copyright on it and all this stuff. So like ebooks and all other sorts of like digital book media is like a thing that publishers are like trying to figure out, because publishers would like to have a copyright over everything, so any iteration right. of your book at all they make money off of. And
whereas as a, I guess the creator, you'd rather have reserve some of the rights to yourself, because then if it turns out that, hey, media form X that nobody knew about until this year, you might get three different places bidding for it.
Yeah, or like you can, so like if they include like a movie rights maybe clause in your contract, for example, a publisher might say, we'll give you like they'll say like, we'll give you like flat fee for like movie rights, and like if you have a good agent, they'll be like, no. We get like X percent of movie rights, because what if someone offers us like a huge payment kind of thing,
right?
So it's really like the copyright thing and who has control over what is really like what the publisher and like the agents kind of hash out. And that's like one of, by the way, if you're interested in being an author, you want an agent, first yeah. of all, because like 90% of published books come through agents, yeah. and also because if you have a good agent, they will make sure the publisher does not fuck you over.
Yeah, John Scalzi, like probably 10 years ago or more now, one of the things he did was he did an informal survey of authors and what their average for like trying to figure out what the average first advance was within specifically science fiction, yeah. and the agented folks' advance was I don't remember off the top of my head how much bigger, but it was like 70 or 100%, somewhere in that range, bigger than the first one given to unagented authors. So even yeah. after the agent's cut, you end up making quite a bit more money.
And a good agent will do stuff like, say, like, we'll realize things like, you're not going to pay me a flat fee for media rights. You're uh-huh. going to give me a little more leeway on XYZ. Like, they'll kind of fight for you more because they know how the contracts work. Whereas, like, even if you're a smart person looking at a book contract for the first time, you're like, I don't know, it looks good, I guess.
You're giving me money, I'll sign.
Yeah, so, and that's actually one of the reasons publishers and libraries traditionally don't belong great, is because publishers don't like that they sell like 10 copies of a book to the library and then like 100 people read those 10 copies right. and they could be selling 100 copies. but that was the other thing I was going to talk about with copyright, is the big, big publishing thing that went on was with Google Books, and it's like still a fight happening to this day. Where Google Books wanted to like scan copies of all of these books and make them available on the internet, and publishers did not like the idea of a bunch of free books popping up on the internet. And so there's this thing where if a book has an expired copyright, so any books written, and this is only in the United States, it's I think it's before 1936. It's in the public domain by now.
Right.
And there are probably, and there are exceptions, like, for example, the Iliad in general is in the public domain, but, like, Robert Fagel's translation of the Iliad is not in the public domain.
Okay.
So, like, you do run into, like, things here and there with stuff like that. But Google Books wanted to have, like, all of these scanned books available, and so they, like, reached this agreement. It was something like, oh, no, I can't remember exactly what it was. But basically what they did is they were, like, going into libraries and just scanning, like, all of these books in these libraries and, like, putting them all up online, and then the publishers were like, And so, like, became this huge thing, and it, like, became this huge court battle. And I guess, like, in the earlier days, Google Books used to have more stuff than it does now, but they're still trying to, like, figure out the legal.
Sure.
Because, like, the argument's like, oh, if you're using, for example, if you're reading a book for academic purposes, professors can give you, like, basically, like, up to, like, let's say 50 free pages of a book, if you're using it for a class. But then if someone gets those 50 free pages of the book for a class and goes and scans it and it makes it widely available on the internet, then you, like, run into a problem.
Right.
So this is, like, a big thing that, like, publishers and Google and lawyers and judges and, like, everyone are fighting about is, like, how much access should there be to this stuff. And it's definitely an ongoing thing. And I can't remember all the specifics, obviously, but if anyone's interested, just, like, go, you know, do Google search about it, and you can, like, read some fun stuff about people fighting about it.
Well, I mean, in copyright, copyright law and rights and whatnot is a whole industry unto itself, from what I can see. Like, there are probably 15 different aspects of copyright you could make a career out of.
Oh, and actually, if you want to work in copyright and publishing, big publishers have rights and permissions departments.
There you go.
That are entirely based around that. So if you are, let's say if you are publishing a nonfiction work and you want to use some awesome thing another scholar said, and you want to use a lot of what they said, or if you, like, if Tony and I ran into this, our friend Tony, when I was helping him with his book, if you want to do, like, a big quote from a text that's not in the public domain, then you have to go ask the publisher who owns that work if you can use that excerpt. It's like, if it's over 150 words or something like that, then you have to ask for permission to use it, and then you have to pay a certain amount to use it. And some excerpts are more expensive than others. Some publishers are super nice, and they're like, oh, this is for an academic text, it's really not that big, just use it for free and give us credit. And some will, like, if you want to use, like, an Ayn Rand quote, then Ayn Rand's estate has to, like, they have to, like, read the context of the quote and make sure you're not misrepresenting her, and then you have to pay them, like, $1,500, like, but that's, like, a whole thing that requires a department of people who sell out permissions and make sure that all of the books that that particular publisher is publishing, like, have all of their permissions under control, and they're not going to accidentally print someone's work without crediting them or paying for it.
Right.
So that's, like, a whole other thing.
I guess on the less technical side of things, maybe getting more into some of the social justice, since we like that. do you know much about, like, author demographics? Or, I mean, maybe not specific numbers, but kind of how they're changing, or within the industry business side of things, you know, like, Hollywood takes a lot of crap fairly for being bad at having non-white people and non-white men, like, be in charge of things. Is that a thing publishing is also dealing with? I assume it is, because I think all of society is dealing with that. But is that a thing publishing is like, doing better at than Hollywood? Is it a thing that they think about and talk about? I think with authors, I think as far as, like, the authors, I think it definitely is from what I've seen poking around the internet in my spare time. But on the business side of thing, do they talk about that at all either?
Yeah, so it's actually been, like, a huge problem that the industry has been talking about, especially in the last couple of years. So we actually... just had a demographic study of the publishing industry, like, released, like, a couple weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And you can look it up. So, the publishing industry is overwhelmingly white, like, really, really white. I don't remember the exact number, it's like 90%.
It's so white.
it is over, it's like 77-80% women.
Huh.
So it's, like, very, very slanted towards women. So the study basically found it's mostly women, mostly white women, mostly straight white women, and mostly able-bodied women. So, like, we don't really have a lot of diversity of people who work on books. I will point out, like, despite that fact, a lot of publishing houses are still run by men.
Uh-huh.
Like, men tend to have the... If they're in work for the publisher, they tend to have, like, the supervisor or, like, the managerial roles.
Hmm.
And that's changing a little bit just because, like the industry's changing that women are, like, getting into some of more of those positions of power.
Well, there's so many women in the industry, they'd almost have to, even if the industry was trying not to let it happen.
Yeah, and then it also depends, like, on the publisher. Like,
sure.
In Boston, there are several independently owned children's book publishers that are owned and run by women. So one of the big things going on is, I don't know if you've heard of the We Need Diverse Books hashtag, but basically, like, there was a group that looked at YA books in particular and realized that almost all of them are about white people. And so there's actually been this, like, change in the industry, and it hasn't, I would say it has not been fixed yet, but more publishers are now aware that, like, there is a problem that needs to be changed and are looking for authors who are not just writing about white kids doing white kid things and marketing and pushing a lot more of their diverse books and, like, actively actually trying to seek those stories out. Some publisher, I don't remember which one, just started a imprint entirely based on, like, Islamic-based stories and books and things like that.
Hmm.
So there's some work being done. I think a lot of the problem going on is that publishers are all in, like, really big cities like San Francisco, New York, and Boston that are really expensive. And usually, like, nowadays, getting into publishing is going to be a lot more likely if you have had the, like, education experience. And so people who come from, like, low-income backgrounds, it's way harder for them because you have to try and, like, get into an expensive school in an expensive city. And then we have the additional problem of publishers pretty much only offer unpaid internships.
Right.
So, like, let's say you do get into this school and you're like, I can afford to go to Emerson if I'm working, like, a full-time job while I'm going to school. You can't afford to work a 10-hour-a-week unpaid internship while you are living in New York City or Boston. Like, it's just not a thing. Like, honestly, a lot of people in publishing are like, I mean, everyone I know took out a ton of loans, but, like, I understand that I'm coming from this privileged position of, like, I could afford to go to grad school because, like, my parents helped pay for undergrad, and, like, I had the luxury of working at an unpaid internship because I have, like, a husband who's willing to work full-time for me, like, while I do this, and not everyone can afford to do that, and because of, like, a lot of the racial divide bullshit craziness in the United States, like, you know, people who come from lower income backgrounds who tend to be, like, more diverse can't necessarily, like, afford to even, like, get involved in the industry. So it's, like, it's a problem. Emerson's actually had a lot of minority students, like, they busted into, like, a faculty meeting or something earlier in the year to talk about it, and Emerson's working on, like, improving its diversity and all that, but, yeah, it's definitely a problem and a big criticism of the industry. I was actually at a children's book panel last week with three people in the industry, and one of the women pointed out it's really weird that the industry is mostly women, because she pointed out that a majority of books that are published, the protagonists are men.
Indeed. And
so we still have, like, a weird patriarchal, like, bent.
What about the demographics of readers?
I don't really know that. I do know that one of the reasons books are getting more diverse is because readers have been demanding it.
Sure.
And actually, I'll go ahead and, like, give them a shout out by name. Barefoot Books, which is a children's publisher in Boston. One of their, like, huge commitments is to diversity. They actually hire diversity and, like, inclusion consultants to make sure that they're, like, doing a good job. Like, they're super duper serious about it. And they said that they've noticed the results in their sales, that their books are selling great because they're, like, actually making an effort to respond to like, the reader's concerns. I don't know exactly who reads what. I do know that as far as authors go, the two genres that I know are dominated by women are romance and YA, which coincidentally are, like, the two genres that, like, literary snobs, like, look down on.
Yeah, go figure, right?
And things suck. but I don't really know about other.
Okay, fair enough. Just curious. My next few questions are not book-related, but related to other areas of publishing. We're about to throw to part two. Now that we're done talking about books, there'll be a second part to this episode. Well, I guess we should wrap this up so Erica can pop some popcorn.
Yeah. So I can go to bed, I think.
Yeah. Oh, it's extra late for you. What are you reading right now, or have just read, or do you even want to talk about it because it's all academic and you're still traumatized?
No, I'm not traumatized. I'm only marginally traumatized. I've actually been trying to read nonfiction lately.
Uh-huh.
So I have my nonfiction book in my purse that I read on the T, and that's what I do. So, like I said, I just finished reading 1776 by David McCullough, which was just literally about, like, the revolution in the year 1776, mostly following around George Washington and his army, and what was going on in Boston and New York. And I actually found it really interesting because I didn't know about that particular part of the revolution, so it was pretty cool. And I am now reading a book called The Woman Who Would Be King by Kara Cooney, which is about Hatshepsut, who was an ancient Egyptian woman who ended up becoming a king of Egypt.
All right.
And it's pretty rad, so I'm digging it.
All right. Well, I finished the... Since the last time we recorded, I finished the Mistborn trilogy by Brandon Sanderson. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. I'm not entirely sure what I make of the ending of it yet, but I don't know, in another month maybe I'll know what I think. I also have been doing some nonfiction. I have had a Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman sitting on my shelf forever. And like,
me too.
Yeah, like a year or two ago, I read the first 500 pages of it. And now I'm going to read the last 150 pages of it because I feel like I should finish it. And it is really interesting, but I'm not sure if I am, I'm remembering retaining more than about 10% of what I read. It's pretty dense. It's pretty interesting though. Barbara Tuchman, of course, good reputation for a reason. She's kind of awesome. All right. Well, I guess if you have comments, questions, complaints, not really complaints. We don't really care, honestly.
If you want to fight with me about my opinions about publishing, that's cool.
Yeah.
I can fight you.
It's all good. I mean, this is self-indulgent. We don't really care if you don't like it.
So true.
So true. But if you have any of those things, you can leave a comment on the website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can tweet us at novelideaspod. That will basically lead you straight to Ben. And if you want to tweet me specifically, you can find me at classicsumup.
We are on iTunes, and we are, as we mentioned, kind of, sort of, at least within the first 10 minutes of the beginning this time, part of the Minerva Mag podcast network at minervamag.com.
Indeed.
So you can reach us any of those ways. I guess next time around, this has gone long enough that I'll probably do some cutting and pasting. So next time around, you'll probably be listening to part two. unless I copy and paste this and just use it twice, in which case, next time, we haven't decided yet.
But you can just call me again and we'll re-record the outro for part two.
You know, I might have you hang around in a second. But I think that's going to do it for this episode, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.